Today on Rear Vision, the regulation of political eavesdropping.
The 29-year-old US government contractor says he was the source of leaks about US monitoring of internet users and phone records. Edward Snowden told The Guardian newspaper he was motivated solely by a desire to inform the public about what he called the massive American surveillance machine.
My name's Ed Snowden. I'm 29 years old. I work for Booz Allen Hamilton as an infrastructure analyst for NSA in Hawaii. I, sitting at my desk, certainly had the authorities to wiretap anyone, from you or your accountant to a federal judge to even the president if I had a personal email. I'm just another guy who sits there day to day in the office, watches what's happening, and goes, this is something that's not our place to decide. The public needs to decide whether these programs and policies are right or wrong.
In recent months, there's been intense global debate about public and political oversight of the massive secret electronic surveillance by US intelligence agencies, all because of Edward Snowden, a former contractor with the NSA, the United States National Security Agency. Hello, I'm Stan Correy, and this is Rear Vision. Today we chart the history of the surveillance state. What accountability mechanisms are there for protecting civil rights? And we focus on what's often labelled in the current debate the trade-off for individuals and governments. What takes priority, security or privacy? Former Australian Privacy Commissioner Malcolm Crompton.
I've been dismayed, first of all, at the quality of the debate about these issues over a long period of time, not just from the time Mr. Snowden made his revelations, because we basically see this polarised discussion that national security or policing or law enforcement or whatever you want to talk about shouldn't be doing any of this. Or the other extreme is we are from national security, law enforcement. If you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear, please just lie back and let us have the lot. Neither of those positions have any intelligence associated with them whatsoever. You need a discussion that is much more nuanced than that, and it's all been discussed before, and it's all been solved before, sometimes over hundreds of years, and we're not bringing this intelligence to the current discussion. The point is that we've always authorised somebody to have special powers of some sort, whether it's literally the legal power of violence, you know, police arresting you, or the legal power to listen in, or the legal power to collect information on you, for example, the electoral office. And then we put down on those people constraints. You can only collect for this reason or exercise that power in some other way. And then there are accountability mechanisms that say, have you done the right thing?
For hundreds of years, lawyers and governments have struggled with the legal regulation of political surveillance. The tension between national security and civil liberties existed at the founding of the US Republic. Dr. Derigan Silver is an assistant professor in the Department of Media, Film and Journalism Studies at the University of Denver and author of the book National Security in the Courts: The Need for Secrecy versus the Requirement of Transparency.
Privacy is something we talk about a lot now because of new communication technologies and the ability to data mine massive amounts of information about average everyday individuals with them not knowing about it and with very little prying into their day-to-day life, or at least prying that they know about. All the prying happens in very covert ways. But what we have had for a long time is this notion that in times of danger, in times of heightened national security, is that we have to give up civil liberties. You know, the United States was founded on this really strong premise of individual civil liberties. And for a long time, we've had this sort of idea that, well, that's all well and good, but in times of crisis, we have to give that up. And that's usually the way that it's approached. Not that we need to have a debate about whether we should give that up, but that we have to give that up. And you can see that in President Obama's comments that he made, that you can't have privacy and security. Sort of this idea that it's a natural to give up our civil rights or our civil liberties during times of crisis. And that concept has been around for a very long time, almost since in the immediate aftermath of the founding. You know, if you look at the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, it was this idea that, well, there might be a chance that we're going to war with France. We have to give up some of our personal freedoms, even though those are the freedoms that we were supposedly just fighting for.
The US President Barack Obama has made his first comments amid a firestorm about the government's broad surveillance of phone records and internet data. It's been revealed the government has been mining data from within the servers of multiple internet companies, including Google, Skype, and Facebook.
Nobody's listening to the content of people's phone calls.
The president attempted to counter what he called the hype. He said Americans should be comfortable with the surveillance because it's done with appropriate checks and balances, including congressional oversight.
You can't have 100% security and also then have 100% privacy.
My initial reaction to the June 5, 6, you know, news stories containing the first revelations coming from Edward Snowden came as no surprise whatsoever. In fact, I was shocked that people had forgotten already that a mere 8 years earlier, you know, the New York Times had broken the story that, you know, the National Security Agency had engaged in what was termed warrantless domestic eavesdropping here in the United States. And then, you know, after the initial uproar, you know, after a couple weeks, you know, the uproar died down and people forgot. And 8 years later, here we are revisiting the same set of issues.
Matthew Ade is a U.S. intelligence historian and author of the book The Secret Sentry, A History of the National Security Agency.
It actually begins during World War II when all the telegraph cables coming into the and out of the United States were tapped by the predecessor to the National Security Agency, because that's where all the diplomatic cables came, you know, going to the embassies here in Washington, came in and out. So we were copying those cables surreptitiously back during World War II. And then when the war ended in 1945, the same predecessor agency to the National Security Agency was desperate to keep their access to these cables. So it clandestinely made arrangements with the big three cable companies. Like today, we have three big telephone companies in the United States. Well, back in 1945, there were three big cable companies, and we cut secret deals with each of these companies, promising them that, you know, unspecified rewards in return for their patriotic cooperation with the U.S. intelligence effort. The whole thing came crashing down around NSA's ears in 1975, 30 years later, when the secret NSA programs, which were called Shamrock and Minaret, were discovered and made public despite frantic efforts by the NSA and the White House to keep them secret. And coming out of that scandal and the Church Committee hearings, which were held looking into the scandal, NSA promised on a stack of Bibles that it would no longer engage in that sort of illegal domestic eavesdropping activities.
The September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks changed everything, and the eavesdropping all began again, and again in secret. In the New York Times in 2005, it was disclosed that the NSA was wiretapping without getting warrants. But that disclosure didn't stop the practice.
Republicans and Democrats have used a congressional committee to jointly attack representatives of the US agencies which have eavesdropped on the public and kept the material on databases going back 7 years. North America correspondent Michael Vincent reports.
Americans are meant to be protected from unreasonable searches and seizures by the Fourth Amendment of their Constitution.
Is there a national security exception to the Fourth Amendment when it comes to American citizens in the United States? Do you see that in the Fourth Amendment? Any of you?
The Guardian journalist Glenn Greenwald, who broke the story about Edward Snowden and the NSA, recently wrote that the crux of the NSA story can be found in one phrase: collect it all. Soon after the Snowden revelations about the National Security Agency, Jeremy Bash, former chief of staff at the CIA, provided this rationale for total surveillance to NBC's Andrea Mitchell.
You've recently left government, so you know what we're talking about here. How does it work, and how are people to be assured that the government is not Big Brother?
Well, Andrea, let's take a specific example. Let's say we get a tip from a foreign intelligence service that a phone call is coming in from Yemen at 2:45 today to a disposable phone in Texas. What we have to do is take the entire database and interrogate the database and look for that pattern. We don't know their names. We don't know their phone numbers. We don't know anything other than what I just described. The only way to do that is if you have all the records in one place at that time. If you're looking for a needle in a haystack, you need a haystack.
In that interview, Jeremy Bash went on to say, when intelligence agencies make mistakes, Congress can provide oversight and the courts can step in and make corrections. But none of this oversight is done in a transparent way. In fact, it's completely secret. The political tradition is, we can't tell you what dangers are out there because they're secret dangers, but trust us. Dr. Derrigan Silver.
If you knew what we knew, you would be doing these things. If you knew what we knew, then you would let us spy on these people, and you would let us spy on you, and you would let us torture people. This has been around for a long time, but Vice President Dick Cheney, when he was in office, was just a master at this. And he would go on morning talk shows and he would say, oh, if you knew what I knew, you would see that this is okay what we're doing. And journalists sometimes would push back and say, well, what is it you know? But a lot of times they wouldn't push back and they would just say, okay, you must know something is really bad. And I think that's the problem that people have. They say, well, okay, government, you can have some secrets, but you need to, like, there has to be a check here, and they can't be all kinds of secrets. And I think people are getting really frustrated with the massive, massive amounts of information that are being kept secret and the complete and total reluctance to share this information with anybody. And we're told again and again, well, it's for your own safety. Well, it's for your own safety. Well, why? Well, we can't tell you that. Well, who have you caught? Well, we can't tell you that either. You know, the Solicitor General was before the Supreme Court, and he was making an argument that there were plaintiffs who wanted to know some information that didn't have standing because this information hadn't been used against them. Nobody had actually prosecuted them for the information that they had gathered. And he said, you know, if this situation ever came up, well, of course, then we would turn over the information. Well, now there are several situations where individuals are being prosecuted for this secret information that was gathered against them, and the government is not turning over the information. And so I think people see that and they say, well, we don't trust you anymore.
Leading the charge, the chief of the National Security Agency, General Keith Alexander, who said the number of terrorist plots prevented by the US government's sweeping phone and internet surveillance was even larger than first thought.
In recent years, the information gathered from these programs provided the US government with critical leads to help prevent over 50 potential terrorist events in more than 20 countries around the world.
The committee chairman, Republican Mike Rogers, led the NSA chief, General Alexander, through the hot button issues.
Is the NSA on private companies' servers?
We are not.
Is the NSA have the ability to listen to Americans' phone calls or read their emails under these two programs?
No, we do not have that authority.
You're with Rear Vision on RN and via the web. I'm Stan Correy, and today we're monitoring the history of the regulation of political surveillance. The legal authority for providing public accountability for US intelligence agencies is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. FISA was set up in the late 1970s after Watergate and revelations that the CIA was involved in domestic spying. Matthew Aid.
In 1978, Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA as we call it, which did place specific limitations on what the National Security Agency could or could not do in terms of eavesdropping on Americans. And this was codified into law. I mean, one of the things that I think distressed and disturbed so many of us was when the New York Times revealed in 2005 the details or sort of the broad brushstroke outlines of the warrantless eavesdropping program that the Bush administration had engaged in the years after 9/11, is that the administration had deliberately gone around the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which was put into place by the FISA law of 1978 for specifically this purpose, you know, to ensure that the National Security Agency did not engage in any illegal or untoward activities.
The word eavesdropping actually comes from the idea of someone standing under the eaves outside your house or outside an establishment listening in. And so things obviously got a lot more sophisticated, but laws protecting liberty have always been playing catch up.
In the history of surveillance, according to Simon Chesterman, threats and technology overwhelm any sense of public accountability. A classic case is the US Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. Professor Chesterman is Dean of the National University of Singapore Faculty of Law and author of the book One Nation Under Surveillance.
One of the big problems that arises is what's referred to in the literature as regulatory capture. So what that means is that if there is an accountability mechanism where the overseers and those who are being overseen operate very closely together in an environment where they share information that is not generally available to the public, there is a danger that the overseer comes to identify most closely with the entity being overseen. And so you have a kind of collaboration in what's meant to be an accountability relationship. It ends up being more of a partnership that can make everything move swimmingly in terms of working efficiently, but it tends to undermine the point of having an oversight mechanism, which is to check abuse, to prevent abuse, but also to ensure that better decisions are made. And that generally seems to happen when there's more of a kind of genuine oversight, a genuine challenging of the decisions that are being made, rather than simply identifying with those decisions. All of this is, of course, very hard to evaluate when we don't know a great deal of what goes on inside these court proceedings. Even those decisions of the FISA court that are released are often redacted, and so it's very hard to have a real sense of how much oversight is going on.
In the English-speaking world, the culture of secrecy coincides with the beginnings of the modern democratic state. Edward Snowden is just one of a long line of whistleblowers who've exposed government surveillance programs. In the 21st century, it is phone and internet surveillance. In 1844, it was personal mail. The target of the British government surveillance then was Italian revolutionary in exile in London, Joseph Mazzini. David Vincent is Professor of Social History at the Open University in the UK and author of The Culture of Secrecy.
Mazzini's mail was the correspondence that was flowing between himself and other Italian republicans in 1844. He was an exile from what is now Italy, which it was then part of the Austrian Empire, and the Austrian government had been chasing him across Europe until he found exile in the United Kingdom. And the Austrian government then asked the British government to open his correspondence, which they did. He had a suspicion, so what he did was that he put into his letters poppy seeds and grains of sand. And when they reached his friends, those microscopic contents were missing. And therefore he assumed that that was proof that somewhere along the line the letter had been opened and these tiny ingredients had fallen out.
And what did he do then? Did he have someone to raise his case?
Yeah, he was well connected in the London radical circles, particularly to a man called Thomas Duncombe, who was a Chartist sympathiser. And it was Duncombe who then, as an MP, who went to Parliament and raised this as an issue with the Home Secretary, Sir James Graham.
According to a newspaper report of the time, Sir James Graham was most shamefully aggravated by the public press and forced to set up an inquiry. But the Select Committee on the Post Office Surveillance was, much to the annoyance of the just-emerging public media, held in secret.
I think it's relevant to our own times for at least two reasons. The first is that 1844 marked the beginning of the modern communication revolution. Britain had invented the penny post in 1840, which was designed to permit mass correspondence. The railways were just being built, and there was a general sense that the whole world was entering an entirely new realm of mass communication. And that connects with our own time in the sense that with the digital revolution, everybody now knows that we're in an entirely different environment of mass communication with all sorts of unknown and threatening implications. That was the first reason why I think it's relevant. The second reason is the way in which the government handled the crisis. It was opening people's letters secretly, but what got it into such trouble was that it refused to discuss publicly what it was doing, refused to establish its practices on a proper legal framework. So it marks the beginning of what is a continuing tradition of governments of all kinds being secret about their secrecy, refusing to make transparent the rules and regulations and frameworks within which they're working. And it was those two things, I think, the beginning of mass communication and the beginning of the tradition of being secret about secrecy, which makes the 1844 event so modern.
A tradition of honourable secrecy was established after the Mazzini affair, a tradition of being secret about secrecy. The tradition lives on today in the Australian Parliament. Last month, Independent Senator Nick Xenophon asked Foreign Minister Senator Bob Carr a question on NSA monitoring of Australian politicians.
Are any email addresses exempt from the Main Way, Marina, Nucleon or prison programs? For example, are the official or unofficial email addresses of members of Parliament exempt? What about internet metadata or content from parliamentary logons?
The Minister.
Mr. President, as a matter of principle and long-standing practice, the government does not comment on intelligence matters. I do reiterate, however, that we have a strong legal framework to protect Australians.
I mean, what is so striking is not only the general sentiment in that tradition, almost the exact words are in that tradition. There's about two sentences which they use, and they all use it. And a very interesting quote you've just given me indicates that in that respect, if in no other, Australia is still firmly within the tradition of its former colonial master.
The honourable secrecy tradition didn't abolish the need for democratic oversight of spying, but the oversight had to be hidden from the public view. David Vincent.
The government responded by saying, you can trust us not to misuse the powers which we are hiding from you, because we are men of honour, because our government and our bureaucrats are brought up to behave honourably, and that we are exercising these powers not as an aggressive claim to power, but as a form of self-denial, that it causes great pain to have to behave like this, but because we have a sense of duty, we have to maintain these powers, but we are honourable, and secrecy is itself an honourable practice. And that in the 19th century works, by and large, and through a good part of the 20th century. And the reason why we're in real some trouble now is that politicians have begun to lose the confidence of their electorates, that they are themselves essentially honourable.
So they've lost the sense of being honourable men or women, so therefore the concept of honourable secrecy gets thrown out as well.
That's right. I mean, this decline has been going really since the Second World War, but it can be seen to be accelerating. But it is the key battleground. If Obama, President Obama, for instance, who has made a great event of his own integrity, if he can use that aura of integrity to maintain his secret state, then he'll get away with it. But if he is seen to be just another politician who doesn't understand what's going on or has been captured by the military security complex, then all is lost. This notion of whether you can trust a government to work out of sight was raised very clearly in 1844 and remains the issue.
The military security complex has a name, the Five Eyes Agreement. This agreement was conceived during World War II and signed shortly after as an intelligence sharing alliance between the US, the UK, Canada, Australia and New Zealand. In the post-Snowden world of espionage, there's a new problem that didn't exist before. Can any national government control what's going on with the surveillance of their citizens? Former Australian Privacy Commissioner Malcolm Crompton.
Many parts of the business that you and I are doing today are passing through processes that are not happening within our jurisdiction. Now, the servers for Gmail or the way your telephone calls are being dealt with or where you're storing your data or a whole lot of other things are not just passing through the US, they're passing through China, they're passing through India, they're passing through all sorts of other things in the world. But the laws that protect us are domestic. They're not international. So you listen to the Americans talking about the safety for Americans of the American process. It's all about the protection of Americans from that American system. Now, you could question whether that's effective for Americans, but by definition, it's certainly not effective for us because we don't even have any skin in that game. GCHQ and all the stuff that it's doing with its projects in the UK, same thing. The only protections that Mr. Haig was talking about related to the protection of British citizens. American citizens, therefore, have a worry about what's happening in the UK program. We should have worries about both of those programs.
In the 18th and 19th centuries, politicians in the first democratic governments struggled to work out their relationship with the governed, the citizens. Political philosophers like John Locke wrote about a contract between citizens and government. Liberal thinkers like Jeremy Bentham campaigned on the need for publicity about what governments did. Dr. Derrigan Silver.
I hope that the average citizen of Australia, of the United States, of the world, is just thinking a little bit more deeply about these issues and is thinking a little bit more about the balance that they want. How do they want their information handled and what kind of powers do they want their government to have? Because ultimately, if Snowden is sort of an interesting story until he is granted asylum someplace, you know, if Russia grants him asylum, if Cuba grants him asylum, if he's only an interesting story until then, and then he disappears, I think we lose something. This is a debate that we've been having, not for the history of the United States, but in some ways, since the history of organized government. You know, if you look to some of the political philosophers, like John Locke, he was very, very much concerned with a contract between the people who were being governed and the people doing the government. And he said, you know, we don't give up all of our rights to the government just to keep us safe. That's not the way it works. We have certain natural rights that we had before a government was formed, and those rights stick with us even after the government is formed. And, you know, and he said, look, yes, it's important that the government protect us from another country invading us. But that doesn't mean that they get to give up respecting those basic rights that we had before we gave them the right to govern us. And that's the debate that we're still having today. You know, the ability to gather information, the ability to store information changes. But at its heart, it is still this 200, 300, 400-year-old debate we're having about, as a individual, I have certain human rights. I will exchange some of those rights in order to live in a civilized society. I will not give up all those rights. And that's just the debate that we're still having today.
Dr. Derrigan Silver is author of the book National Security in the Courts. Other guests, Malcolm Crompton, former Australian Privacy Commissioner, Professor David Vincent, author of The Culture of Secrecy, intelligence historian Matthew Aid, and Simon Chesterman, Dean of Law at the National University of Singapore. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can find a podcast and a transcript at the Rear Vision website. And while you're there, drop us a line. Today's sound engineer is Timothy Nicastri. I'm Stan Correy, and this is Rear Vision on RN. Thanks for your company.